A lot of times it's a lot early.
Oh, let's do that. Okay. So I should just get started. Okay. Well, we're almost to the bitter end. There are two more topics to discuss, and only one of them today is about things we actually know. So let's finish the things we actually know. Tomorrow I'll tell you about some things we don't know. So we've made now almost a complete theory of weak interactions, but there are still some things that are left out of it. Because so far I've only talked about the weak interaction transitions between up and down, charm and strange, and top and bottom. But there are weak interaction transitions that cross over from one side to the other, and you know that. For example, the kaon can decay to mu nu, so that's something where a strange quark has to disappear, and it annihilates either the up or down antiquark in the kaon. Similarly, k can also decay to pi mu nu. And so in that process, again, a strange quark has to annihilate a quark of a lighter type. And then there are also processes like the baryon weak decays, lambda goes to p pi minus. Again, a strange quark has to, well, all of these things have to contain the process s goes to u mu nu, or maybe in this case, s goes to u u bar d. So we still need to talk about how this fits into the SU2 cross U1 model. So an interesting thing about this type of process is that while the strange quark can annihilate a light quark through the charged current, strange quarks apparently do not annihilate charged quarks, light quarks, through the neutral current. So for example, if the process S to D mu plus mu minus occurred, then you could use this to make a decay of the neutral kaon to mu plus mu minus. So this thing contains a D quark and an anti-S quark. So without completely defining my terms, let me write some numbers on the blackboard. The branching ratio for a meson called the K-long, which I'll tell you exactly what it is a little later, to pi e nu is 41%. The branching ratio for the K-long to to pi mu nu is 27%. There's some phase space suppression for this. The branching ratio for this same particle, k long, to mu plus mu minus, is 7 times 10 to the minus 9. So somehow this can only occur by some very suppressed higher order process, whereas these occur directly. This one is there. This one is not there at the level of the Lagrangian, although you can generate it at some extremely small level by loop diagrams you can build out of these things. Okay, now, if you like, you can estimate the strength of these processes. For example, this process lambda goes to p, sorry, we need a better example. Lambda goes to p e nu is very similar to beta decay. I've just traded a down quark for a strange quark. And so if you measure this rate, and you compare it to the rate of beta decay, you can deduce the absolute strength of this strangeness-changing weak interaction. And you can also test whether it's V minus A. And so you can do this in lambda and sigma decays. Actually, it turns out that the nicest way to do it is in K decays. So if you think about this process here, K goes to pi mu nu. What you get is a matrix element between a kaon and a pion state of the weak current. Okay, now there's no parity flip here. These both have odd parity. So it's only the vector current that can appear here. So this is something like S bar gamma mu u or d, or sorry, u that appears here. So that current matrix element, you know exactly what it is in the limit where the pi and k are Goldstone bosons. That is where you ignore the up, down, and strange quark masses. And so this thing is equal to f plus of q squared times p pi plus pk, where f plus of q squared equals 0 is 1 when the up, down, and strange quark masses go to 0. And then you can systematically compute the corrections to that limit in perturbation theory in these masses. And so then you basically combine that analysis with data from the Chloe experiment at Frascati. And very recently, they got a very accurate value of the strength of this transition. So apparently, that transition has the strength 0.2237 plus or minus 0.0013 relative to G Fermi over the square root of 2. So if you think of the unit strength of the transition as being 4 G Fermi over the square root of 2, what's in the amplitude in this process is an extra factor, which I've called here VUS, which has this value. So square it 4.5%. So roughly all the things being equal, and if you could somehow set the strange quark mass to be equal in mass to the down quark mass, then a strangeness changing weak interaction would have 4.5% of the rate of an ordinary up to down weak interaction. So it's not so obvious how to sandwich this in to the other stuff in the standard model. But there's one more oddity in the weak interactions, which I told you I was going to tell you about, but I didn't exactly tell you what it was. So in our discussion of the G minus, the V minus A theory, I told you about something called CVC, conserved vector current, which is the statement that the vector part of the weak current is not renormalized. So this allows you, in principle, to make a very precise theory of certain kinds of beta decay. Those kinds of beta decay, again, that don't flip parity and involve only the vector part of the V minus A structure. So people investigated this. A very nice system is a system where you have a zero and where you have an isotriplet of zero plus states. So for example, some nucleus with two protons, a nucleus with proton-neutron, and a nucleus with neutron-neutron. And very often, this state will be the lightest one. And these two guys will both beta decay to that state. And then these guys are part of an isotriplet. They all have the same parity. So the matrix element will just involve the vector current. In this case now, d bar gamma mu u, or maybe the other way around, between these multiplets. The matrix element here will be quite similarly 2p mu, or the momentum of that plus the momentum of that, times f1 of q squared equals 0. And you remember that in the discussion of CVC, of the V minus A theory, we have this property CVC, that f1 of q squared equals 0 is equal to 1, and it gets no renormalization. So this is strictly true when the up and down quarks are exactly equal in mass. But again, one can go through and do perturbation theory in that mass difference. These masses are really small compared to the nuclear scale anyway, and get a very accurate value of the strength of this transition. And the answer is quite remarkable. It's VUD, let's call that number, is 0.97, it's known very accurately now, 0.97418 plus or minus 0.00026. So there are two interesting things about that number. The first is that it's extremely close to 1, thus qualitatively verifying the CVC hypothesis. But the second thing is that it's not 1. In fact, it's well out, 1 is well outside the error bar on this measurement. And so this was a problem for a long time. Well, these are the current values of these numbers. In the early 60s, this was about 0.98. And this number was known to be about 0.22 or 0.23. But people understood that something was really out of whack. And so this was all put together in 1963 by Khabibo. And what Khabibo said was these were two facets of the same thing. And in fact, what the strange quark does is it borrows a little of the amplitude of the down quark to make its weak interaction transitions. So Khabibo said, this guy is the sine of some angle, now called the Khabibo angle. This guy is the cosine of some angle. And we can test this by seeing if sine squared plus cosine squared theta Khabibo is equal to 1. And of course, Khabibo didn't have very accurate data, so it was just a guess. But today, we can actually do this calculation. The answer is 1 minus 0.0004 plus or minus 0.0007. So apparently, it's right. Yes? So before I wrote down this expression for the weak interaction, minus 4G Fermi times J mu is J nu. And so what I want to do here is, in beta decay, we'll have a strangeness changing current. And we'll have a leptonic current. And then the V is some number that I'm going to put in front of this to give the strength of that of this amplitude relative to U and V. That's what it is. And then you put that into your Lagrangian, calculate the amplitudes, and then get predictions for the rate. And those predictions will involve this. OK, so now we have a very interesting idea. That according to Khabibo, the weak current should be not u bar gamma mu d, it should be u bar cosine theta times d plus sine theta times x. And with this form, we can account for both of the puzzles that I've just explained. OK, but now we end up with another puzzle, which is historically somewhat more attractive. So another thing that I haven't told you about, well, there's lots of particle physics I haven't told you about. Another thing that I haven't told you about is the following thing. Let's think about K0, which is a ds bar state. And the K0 bar, which is a D bar S state. These guys have the same quantum numbers, namely their zero charge. They have opposite isospin, but we know that isospin really isn't quite a good symmetry because the up and down quark masses aren't exactly equal. They have the same parity. And in fact, there's no reason why there can't be transitions from K0 to K0 bar. So in fact, K0 and K0 bar have a non-trivial mass matrix, M acting on these states, K0, K0 bar, is equal to something I can write as MK, a half delta MK, a half delta MK and MK, like that. Sorry, what?
What is the mix?
Mix.
Okay, so if these two states mix, then instead of writing down the mass, I have to write down the matrix that acts on these two states. And then I'll find the actual masses by diagonalizing that matrix. Okay, so this would be like a Farquhar mass of the KM. And these guys are equal by CPT. And then there's some off diagonal element if there's a transition from the K0 to K0 1. Okay, and I'll write down such an amplitude in just a moment. Okay. So then if I diagonalize this matrix, I'll find two states which are separated by the mass gap delta K. And so actually, this is known, and I'll tell you how you measure delta mk in just a moment. The value is quite interesting. Mk is 498 MeV, and delta mk is 3.5 times 10 to the minus 12 MeV. So the ratio here is 10 to the minus 14. Okay, so it's a very weak transition. But nevertheless, these two numbers are exactly equal by CPT. So any tiny transition will cause a splitting. Now, the effect of the splitting turns out to be profound. And that is because the neutral kaon can decay either to two pions or to three pions. So let me construct two states, which are called the k-long and the k-short. The k-long is this combination. The K short is the opposite combination. And these are obviously the eigenstates of this matrix. Okay. The K long has CP equals minus 1. That is to say, the parity is odd, and C interchanges these two states. And K short has CP equals even. Now, something very weird happens. Both K0 and K0 bar can decay to two pions, and they can also decay to three pions. Ordinarily, one of these decays would be forbidden by parity, but we know that the weak interactions violate parity. These states also have different CP. This state is CP even. This state is CP odd. That is to say, the three-pion system in each case is taken by C into itself, and then the P of the pions is odd. So here I get plus, here I get plus. OK, well, now you see what's going on. This linear combination can decay only to three pions if CP is conserved. And this one can decay only to two pions. OK, now, two pions, that's a totally open decay. Three pions, first of all, you've got three-body phase space, which brings in this factor of 128 pi cubed in the denominator. And secondly, the 3 times the mass of the pion is almost the mass of the kaon, so this channel is almost completely closed. So the lifetimes are quite different. Let me quote the C tau. For this, the C tau is 2.5 centimeters. And for this one over here, the C tau is 15.34 meters, 600 times longer. So typically, you would do an experiment like this. You'd take protons. You'd hit them against a nuclear target. You make a beam of kaons. You make both K0 and K0 bar. But if you look at the quark content, probably you're more likely to make the thing that has a quark that's actually in the proton. So you make more K0s. The K0s come streaming out in this direction. They start decaying. But the decay depends on the CP. So in a few centimeters over here, half of the kaons in the beam decay to 2 pions. And then over a scale of meters, the other half of the kaons decay to 3 pions. Very weird. It's a macroscopic quantum interference phenomenon. I mean, macroscopic means, you know, over distances you can really, you know, grasp with your hands. I'm going to say more about this system in a moment. But what I'd like to concentrate on now is the value of delta MK. So now to make Bruno happy, I have to write down a diagram that allows the K0 to turn into the K0 bar. So let me do that, and then let me estimate it. So once again, much more about this later in the lecture. Here's a diagram that lets K0 turn into K0 bar. We can have double weak annihilation. So this is a DS bar. And here an up quark can flow. And then I can have a W minus and a W plus. And then out the other end, S and D bar can come. And there it is. OK, it can happen. OK? So, and then there's another similar diagram in the T-channel. So these always go together. So we'll have a few more examples like this. I'm not going to draw this one. I'll just draw this one. OK, let's estimate this diagram. So it's not so easy to get the exact number, but it's pretty easy to get an estimate. The value of this diagram is d4k slash over 2 pi to the fourth. So if k is the momentum that goes around this loop, I have to integrate over that momentum. There are two W propagators that give something like this. There are two up quark propagators. We might as well just ignore the up quark mass. There is a factor of g at these vertices to the fourth. And then when you do the integral, you're going to get something like this. We're going to get this g to the fourth, so there'll be an alpha weak. The integral is, there are two of those things. So the integral has 6 powers of momentum in the numerator and 8 powers in the denominator. So there'll be a 1 over mw. So probably there'll be 1 alpha weak and 1 g Fermi in it. And that's the whole deal. Oh, and then at these vertices, there'll be a VUD squared and a VUS squared. And that's good. So VUD is close to 1, VUS is 5%. Multiply all the numbers together, and you get something like 1.6 times 10 to the minus 10. Oh, sorry. There's some other factors from the kaon wave function. But what this actually estimates is m delta mk over mk. And to make this, sorry, I left out some factors. Please excuse me. We'd like to estimate delta mk over mk. This has the dimensions of mass squared. What comes out of 1 over mass squared, to make this delta mk over mk, we need some factors from the kaon wave function. That's actually f pi, because this thing is like a current matrix element on each side in the kaon. So f pi squared comes here. When you multiply all that together, that's a dimensionless number. It's 10 to the minus 10. So 10 to the minus 10 is awfully small, but it's not small enough. We need 10 to the minus 14, so we missed by 4 orders of magnitude. So this is definitely a bad thing, and it was one of the major puzzles about the theory of weak interactions in the 1960s. Glashow, Iliopoulos, and Maiani made the following proposal for how to solve this problem. They said, well, what we need to do is to combine this element, ds going through u, with another element which will almost completely cancel it. And to do that, we must, this is now in the late 60s, we must postulate the existence of a fourth quark. And so they said, well, there has to be some other quark, which Glashow, for sentimental reasons, called the charm quark, which appears here. This vertex is VUD. This vertex here is VUS. So they said, well, what if we put VUD here, and we put minus VUS here? Then these things have a nice cancellation. Instead of this factor here, we'll get k slash plus mc over k squared minus mc squared minus k slash plus mu over k squared minus mu squared is equal to mc minus mu over k squared minus something. Okay, well, now we've got an extra factor of k in the denominator. This integral got more convergent. It converges without having to use the k squared that's in the w propagator now. And so now I get an extra factor of mc over mw squared. And the mass of the w is about 100 GeV. So if the mass of the charm is about 1 GeV, I'll now get the right answer. So actually, these guys did all this in an environment where people didn't even believe in the quark model. So actually, whenever they said there was a fourth quark, everyone thought they were nuts. But anyway, it makes a nice expression over here, because it now says that the C couples to the orthogonal linear combination of D and S. And so now we have the four quarks, at least, in a very nice package as far as the weak interactions. And, well, let me just remind you that shortly after this, so this was in 1970, so then in 1974, the JSI was discovered. And everybody said, oh my god, these guys got it right. Okay. So now we have a very satisfactory theory of weak interactions, at least for four quarks. And so let me now go back and try and explain how this fits into the kind of broader picture that we had of the weak interactions of the standard model. So what I'd like to do now is try to derive this picture from first principles insofar as we can. And by first principles, I really mean first principles. We'll just try and work from the gauge symmetry of the standard model and nothing else. So if I just go postulate that the symmetry of the theory is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, that there are four quarks for the moment, U, D, S, and C. There are four leptons, E, nu, mu, and tau. Let's just work with this theory for the moment and see where it gets us. I want to now write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian consistent with the symmetries of the theory. So first of all, we can write the kinetic energy term. So first of all, there's the sum over A equals 1, 2, 3, of 1 quarter f mu nu squared for 1, 2, and 3. OK, actually, there's no freedom here. The only parameters are the three coupling constants. That's the only thing you can write. Now let's write down the sum over all the fermions in the theory of f bar I d slash f. OK, well, there's still no freedom, because the covariant derivative is completely specified once I've specified the representations that those particles live in. So even up to here, there's no freedom in the theory except the freedom to specify the three coupling constants. In particular, up to here, the theory is exactly CP conservative, because all the coupling constants are real. So now, let's just keep going. The other thing that we can add, as I told you at the end of Tuesday's lecture, are some terms that would couple the Higgs fields to the fermions, which I told you are necessary in order to give the fermions mass. So what I'd like to do now is not write down just the minimal thing that gives masses to these particular quarks and leptons. I'd like to write down the most general interaction of that kind, consistent with the gauge symmetry. Let's start for quarks. So for quarks, that interaction would be something like this. Lambda d ij qi bar dot phi dr j minus lambda u ij q bar I a epsilon a b phi star b u r j, where I'm going to group these. I'm going to call, for example, q to be q1 is the ud doublet, q2 is the cs doublet. Similarly, u1 will be the right-handed u, and u2 will be the right-handed c quark, and so on. So these indices here run over 1 and 2. And gauge symmetry doesn't forbid an arbitrary mixing of those indices. In fact, the lambdas don't even have to be Hermitian. I'm going to add the Hermitian conjugate. So the lambdas can be totally arbitrary, complex 2x2 matrices. There's no restriction on the lambdas from gauge invariants. And then I might as well just say, for the leptons, there's a similar thing, lambda L, ij, L, which is the lepton doublet indexed by 1 for E mu, 2 for mu nu, dot phi, and then E right j. OK, so this, it turns out, is the most, and then we have to add the Higgs interaction, d mu phi squared, and the Higgs potential. And it turns out that there's one more term called the theta term that you can add. The theta term is related to the physics of this axial vector anomaly that I've been not telling you about. The one thing we know about the theta term is that it's extremely small. If it were there, it would induce a neutron electric dipole moment. The neutron electric dipole moment, people have searched for it. The current limit is 10 to the minus 13 of the size of the neutron. So if this term were there, it would have no effect on the rest of the argument. And so I needn't even tell you what it is, although you can look it up somewhere. OK, so this is now the most general Lagrangian with the symmetries of the standard model with two generations of quarks and leptons. OK, but of course, it's not the simplest form of this Lagrangian. It's just the most complicated thing we could write down. So let me now simplify it a little. So let me take the lambda d, for example. So lambda d is a 2x2 complex matrix of general form. But any such matrix I can actually write in the with the following expression. U dagger lambda v. Let me just make sure this is exactly, yeah. Where u and v are unitary 2x2 matrices, and lambda is real, positive, and diagonal. And why am I allowed to do that? Well, if I wrote lambda d dagger, that would be a Hermitian matrix, so I could diagonalize it. If I wrote lambda d dagger, lambda d, that would be a Hermitian matrix, so I can diagonalize that. U is the matrix that diagonalizes this one. V is the matrix that diagonalizes this one. And then this thing's diagonal, so these are different matrices in general, but that's this thing I can make diagonal, real, and positive. OK. Now, that being so, we could try and absorb these Vs and Us by changes of variables on the quark fields. So, for example, let's define d right prime is equal to Vd times d right. So now I've done a rotation on the d right fields, and I've absorbed the factor of Vd, which is in this formula, and I can make a similar rotation on the U on the d left fields to absorb the U. Now I've made a change of variables, so that change may show up somewhere else in the Lagrangian, and in particular, it might show up in here. However, because left and right are separated in here, the Vs actually cancel out. In particular, the kinetic term for d right is now equal to d right prime of V I d slash V dagger d right. But now the V just cancels the V bar. And it just totally disappears from the theory. The d right also is present here in the electromagnetic current and in the weak neutral current. But in both of those objects, it occurs in the form d bar right gamma mu d right times some charge. So once again, I can do this manipulation. V gamma mu V dagger d right. And then the Vs cancel. And they just disappear. And similarly, in the Z current, as long as in the original form, all the down quarks have the same V quantum numbers, so whatever's in here commutes with V, the Vs just multiply away, and they're never seen again. So very cool. The V can be completely eliminated from the theory. And similarly, the Vs here and here can be completely eliminated from the theory. Now, what about the Us? Well, for the Us, I can do the same argument. But I get stuck at one place, which is the charge-changing weak current. So if I try and do this trick on the current U bar gamma mu d, first of all, only the U's appear, because only the transformation of the left-handed fields will contribute to that. And then this is equal to U prime times U sub U times gamma mu times U dagger sub D times D prime. So now UU and UD are different because I just took these two matrices to be totally arbitrary matrices. And so this term actually doesn't go away. And I'd like to write it in the following form. As gamma mu, a matrix I'm going to call VCKM for reasons I'll tell you about later. And this is the left-handed current. And everywhere else, these matrices go away. By the way, for leptons, as long as I don't have masses for the neutrino, I can just take the U to transform the entire lepton doublet. So then the U's go away everywhere. Basically, what that means is that I'm defining the electron neutrino to be the thing created with an electron in beta decay. So at the end of the day, we arrive at the following structure. All this complexity has gone away. These terms have now turned into totally diagonal terms like this, which, because lambda is real positive and real and positive, are just the terms that give mass to the quarks and leptons. There's no flavor change in these interactions. So here there are mass terms and there are Higgs interactions. And maybe what I should do is also go to the special gauge where I remove the Goldstone bosons. So then these also become diagonal. So now here I just have d bar v plus 1 over square root of 2 v plus hd, and similarly here. Okay. So I have diagonal, I have masses, I have diagonal couplings of the Higgs. Everything else is actually, all these terms are actually individually C and P invariant. The CP non-invariance comes because the W and Z couplings are handed, but those couplings actually also are CP invariant. The only chance that we have of actually any CP violation in this entire theory is if there are complex parameters in VCKM. Oh, and I'd also like you to note one more thing. If I send the masses of the W and Z to infinity, then this theory automatically becomes a theory of vector currents, which have the same interaction for left and right. So what I've done now is that I've started with the gauge symmetry, and I've proved the following facts about the standard model. First, if I only consider the strong and electromagnetic interactions, the theory is separately C and P invariant. Second, if I only consider the weak interactions, then the theory is CP invariant with a possible CP violation if there are complex parameters in VCKM. And third, the Higgs couplings of the theory do not change flavor, and they're all separately C and P invariant. And now I'd just like to do one more trick for you to complete this whole structure. So now, in the weak current, we've now decided that the weak interaction current has the form, I'm now going to drop all the primes, gamma mu VCKM D, where V is a 2 by 2 acting on these two left-handed down quarks and the two left-handed up quarks. So a general 2 by 2 complex matrix, a unitary matrix, can be written in the following form. Oh, let me just try and be a little more careful here. So there are four phases, but one of those phases is constrained by unitarity. I think it's screwed up in my notes. So this phase over here has to be gamma plus beta in order for these two rows to be orthogonal to each other. OK, well now, this guy multiplies the up quark. So if I send up to, if I send e to the I alpha up equal to up prime, if I send e to the I gamma charm equal to C prime, and I send, so this now acts on, sorry, I'm a little confused here. The top row acts on D and S, and it's going to be sandwiched in between U and C. So if I send e to the I alpha D equal to D prime, e to the I gamma S equal to S prime, and then to get rid of this row here, I did it right the first time. Anyway, there are three phases, and you can get rid of them with three phase transformations. On three of the quark fields. The overall phase transformation has no effect. It just cancels out of the phase of this matrix. But anyway, there are three phases. I can make these changes of variables and remove them. So now VCKM is just cosine, sine, sine, cosine with no phases. That gives me exactly the weak current that I wrote here. And There is no CP violation in the theory. CP violation has totally vanished from the theory. Yes?
Complex parameters give you a CP violation.
Because C changes psi to psi dagger, as you proved yesterday in your Tuesday in the tutorial. And if you change psi to psi dagger, but you keep all the parameters real, then you change the theory. Okay? So if I have a coupling of let's say, u bar gamma ud, and there's some real coefficient g, then C will change this to d bar gamma u with d. If g is complex, this is not the complex, it's always plus Hermitian function. So C turns this expression into this one. And then this should be equal to that, and that should be equal to that. But if g is complex, it doesn't work. Another way to see it is that CPT is always a symmetry, so we can look for T violation. Now, T will change G as a G star because it's anti-unitary. So T changes this into that times G star, and it changes this into this, again, with a complex conjugation. So one way or the other, we need a complex parameter in order to get CP and T. Okay, and we do not have it in this model. In this model with four quarks, we can rewrite the Lagrangian to a completely CP invariant form. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. Where is the weak interaction in your Lagrangian?
It's in here. There's a double
each. It's not the same flavor on both sides of the.
Sorry?
When you write f bar, it slash f bar.
But remember, there's a term here which is q times w, and then this raising generator q. So there's u here and z.
Okay, so it says matrices.
That's right. And so that's exactly the structure you see here and over there. So we've now written this object here by an appropriate change of variables exactly in this form. And all the CP violations. So we've proved from the basic principles of the standard model that the standard model of four quarks is CP conservative. Now, this would be great, except that CP is actually violated. And the violation of CP is very subtle. For a long time, it was observed only to occur in the K0, K0 bar system. So I told you about the K0, K0 bar system. There's a meson, as I said, K short, K is the 2 primes. There's a meson K long. So we start out with K0, K0 log. We now diagonalize their Hamiltonian. We get two eigenstates. K short, that decays to 2 primes, and K long, that decays to 2 primes. Except that, in 1964, in very careful experiments on this system, Christensen, Cronin, Fitch, and Turley showed that this state also decays to 2 primes. So given everything I told you before, this can only occur if CP is violated. If you look at that now, the figures, page 2, you see some beautiful examples. So the first one shows a somewhat later CERN experiment set up in the way that I described, where you shine protons on a nuclear target, and you look at the K zeros that are coming out the back end. In particular, you look for 2 pi on states that are coming out. So as I said, in the first few centimeters, you see a huge number. Please notice the log scale on the left, a huge number of pi on states. And then it goes down by 3 orders of magnitude. And then there's some funny interference. And then finally, it levels off at a non-zero value. And so It turns out that the branching ratio for k long here in 2 pi is small. It's 3 times 10 to the minus 3. Remember, the ordinary leptonic decays of k long are, you know, order 40%. So this CP violating interaction is suppressed compared to an already suppressed weak interaction. So it's about the weakest interaction you can imagine measuring a particle. Nevertheless, these guys, Christensen, Cronin, Fitch, and Carlet, showed that it's non-zero, and it corresponds to the violation of. And I think in the next slide, figure 3, there's another very beautiful example. If I make k zeros in this situation, I said that most of them are k zeros, not k zero bars. A k zero has an anti-strange in it, so it's a case to a positron. A k zero bar decays to an electron. So in particular, we can look for these decays. So we can, for example, look at the asymmetry, the delta of positrons minus electrons over positron plus electrons. So right behind the target, these guys are mostly k zeros, so this delta is very large. But then what happens is all the k shorts decay away, and in the k long, you have a roughly equal mixture of k0 and k0 bar. In fact, the equations I wrote before were correct. You would have exactly. So that's the implication of CP. So, but what happens is that after some period of very interesting, as you see in the slide, quantum interference over centimeters, it levels out to a non-zero value. Delta is equal to 3 times. Same, it's not the same expression, but it's very close to the same. And in fact, people showed that these two numbers have the same root, that somehow in the transition between k0 and k0 bar, there's a CP violating phase. But no one knew the origin of that. So there were many theories about it. So there's one theory that's particularly interesting for us, which is that in 1972, two Japanese physicists, Kobayashi and Maskawa, reasoned that if we just had two more quarks, we could solve this problem. So let's do the counting. If we have now 6 quarks, U, D, C, S, T, and B, then V, C, K, M is 3 by 3 unitary. So a 3 by 3 unitary matrix has 9 parameters, of which there are 3 angles, the Euler angles, and 6 phases. And then by doing these kind of phase transformations on the quarks, we can remove 5 phases. But we can't remove them all because an overall complex rotation of all the fields has no effect on VCKM. So we're left with 1 phase. And they said, well, 1 phase is all you need. It's the unique origin of CP violation permitted by the gauge symmetries of the standard model. Of course, this was in 1972, before the Chomp quark was even discovered. So everyone thought they were even more crazy than Glashow, Eliopoulos, and Mayani. But nevertheless, it turned out to be right that these quarks exist, T and V, of course. So I told you about the discovery of the upsilon. Unfortunately, we slid a lecture, so I didn't have a chance to tell you about the discovery of the top quark, but I'll post some notes about it. So these particles actually exist. Also, of course, there's a third generation of leptons, the tau and the new tau. The quarks coming along with the leptons is actually a prediction of the standard model. But once again, it's based on this axial vector anomaly thing. So you just have to trust me that that works. This whole structure of quarks has been discovered. A lot of these VCKM matrix elements have been now measured. And there's only one question that remains, which is, can this structure actually explain CP violation? So let me try in the last 5 minutes to wrap that up. OK, so now one can go measure some of these. After you discover the bottom quark, you can go measure some of these quantities. So in particular, we know the value of VCB from the strength of, for example, B to charm L nu transitions. That number turns out to be a lot smaller than the numbers we were talking about before. 4 times 10 to the minus 2. And by studying processes like B to rho L nu and B to pi L nu, you can measure the strength of a B to U transition. And that number turns out to be even smaller, 4 times 10 to the minus 3. So somehow the CKM matrix, so now I can give it its proper name. It's the Kibibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix, is very hierarchical. The off-diagonal elements get smaller and smaller the more off-diagonal they get. I'm going to write down here a very convenient parametrization of this matrix due to Wolfenstein. Can you see this? The sun is a little, is this OK? That's just in my eyes, I guess. VCKM is equal to 1 minus lambda squared over 2, lambda minus lambda, 1 minus lambda squared over 2. So this is an approximation to this sine, cosine, sine, cosine structure that we had with Kibibo. Then let me call this here A lambda squared. Let me call this A lambda cubed times rho minus I eta. Down here, we have 1 minus A lambda squared and A lambda cubed times 1 minus rho minus I eta. And so there are 4 parameters, 3 angles and a phase. This matrix is unitary up to terms of order lambda to the fourth. Lambda is what I called before sine theta Kibibo. So it's 0.22. So lambda to the fourth is actually comfortably below the level of the current accuracy of these parameters. A, rho, and eta are all parameters of order 1. And actually, we have this and the absolute value of that nailed from these two measurements. So actually, on that basis, we know everything in this matrix except for the phase. And now the question is, how do you get that? So one way to get it is to try directly to explain the strength of CP violation in KDK. And that you can explain because now we have a new diagram, a new set of diagrams with the top quark here. This vertex contains VTD, which in this convention is one of the places where there is a complex phase. And so this diagram contributes a CP violating term to KK bar mixing. However, this is not a very good way to get this number. We have to take the matrix element of this in the CAN wave function. Things get complicated. There's a large uncertainty in even what the value of the phase is that explains KK bar mixing. What you want to do is to go to a much cleaner system where you can possibly measure this phase directly. And this is all written up in the notes, and I really don't have time to talk about it on the blackboard. But there's a beautiful way to do that by looking at a bottom quark mixing. So B0 and B0 bar also mix with each other. The diagrams are very similar to the ones that we wrote before. with a B bar now and a top quark going here. There we go. Okay, now the VTB appears here, but it's appearing in the dominant term. So there's a large phase in this mixing matrix. You can then look at decays of B and B bar to CP eigenstates. For example, the state psi k short is a state of definite CP minus 1. And if you make a B meson, there are two ways to get from here to here. The first is that you can go directly to psi k short. The second is that you can oscillate to a B bar, and then you can go to psi k short. And because of this diagram, VTB has the phase e to the I beta, and there's another one down here. This amplitude has the phase e to the 2i beta. E to the I beta is the phase of that matrix element down there, 1 minus rho plus I beta. And these two matrix elements here are equal by the CP invariance of the strong interactions. So these are really complicated decays. The bottom quark has to turn into a charm quark. It has to emit a W. The W has to turn into CS bar. This has to reform into a psi. And this has to reform into a K meson. And no one really knows how to accurately compute the matrix element for this process, you know, really getting all the terms to high precision. But fortunately, it doesn't matter, because this amplitude is exactly equal to that amplitude by the CP symmetry of the strong interactions. So the only difference is that this root has an extra factor of e to the 2i beta. So then what you do is you set up a situation described in the notes where you can literally watch these B's decay in time. And from that, you can extract the value sine 2 beta is equal to a number, 0.686 plus or minus 0.023. And so we can actually get the phase. And then if you put other final states here, like rho, rho, or d, K, you can get other phases, which are the phases of other elements of this matrix. Okay. The final situation is described on the last two slides, so why don't we just skip to them. What you see are the current experimental constraints on the parameters rho and eta. And so the constraints come from the value of VUB, which comes from B decays to up quarks, the mass mixing both of B0 and B0 bar and of B sub S bar, and the CPA symmetries in these three decays. And as you see, all five of those measurements come together and overlap in a common region of this plane, testing the consistency of the model. And in fact, the overlap region is very small, so these parameters are now known quite well. And if you look at in the second slide, there's a blow-up of the region. You see there's a green swath that comes across like this, labeled epsilon k. And that's the region of the parameters needed to give the correct CP-violating contribution to KK-bar mixing. So apparently, the whole picture fits together. We really seem to understand where CP violation comes from in particle physics as a result of the one phase in this Kibibo-Kobayashi-Moskawa matrix. OK, that's it for today. There's more about how you do this experiment in the notes, which I will post shortly. And tomorrow, we'll talk about the Higgs boson.